Dietz and Watson's been making meats and cheeses the right way since forever. What's that mean? It means never cutting corners, ever. It means cooking, not processing. It means our Virginia brand ham that's cooked to perfection, then twice baked to layer the flavors. It takes more time, but you can taste the difference. We come to work every day to do it the right way, even if it's the hard way. Because if it's not right for us, it's not right for you. Dietz and Watson, it's a family thing since 1939.
Get your advanced PhD in WOW from Floor and Decor. If you're a pro, you're already an expert in tile, wood, and stone. And with Floor and Decor's job site delivery, their free design services, and pro rewards that actually reward you, your business is set to grow from one client to the next. Floor and Decor isn't just a couple of aisles. It's an entire store designed to help your business boom. It's Floor and Decor. Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. So in the quest to become the men we want to be, we're often our own worst enemies, especially when it comes to our egos. Egos is what prevents us from being humble and teachable when we're first starting out in an endeavor. It blinds us to our own weaknesses during success and can cause us to wallow in self-pity when we fail. My guest today is Ryan Holiday, and in his latest book, Ego is the Enemy, he discusses how ego can thwart our personal progress and success as men. Today on the show, we look at examples from history of great men whose hubris caused their downfall and other men who were able to successfully harness their ego to attain greatness. Along the way, provide actionable steps that you can do to prevent ego becoming your enemy. After the podcast is over, make sure you check out the show notes at aom.is/ego, where you can find links to resources mentioned throughout the show. And so without further ado, Ryan Holiday and Ego is the Enemy. Ryan Holiday, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, it's good to be here. I think last time we talked, you were recording this from your closet, and I could see you on the thing.
Yeah, well, I'm still recording from my closet.
All right. Okay, very cool.
You just can't see me. still going old school here. So you got a new book out, Ego is the Enemy. Before we talk about the details of the book, let's start off talking about what do you mean by ego exactly? Are we talking Freudian ego? What is it?
Yeah, so definitely not Freudian ego, not even psychologist ego. I think I'm referring to it. Well, I know I'm referring to it. I'm referring to it in the colloquial sense, the sort of know it when you see it ego. You know, what Bill Walsh would say is when self-confidence becomes arrogance. You know, when I'm using it as an umbrella term to define sort of all of the characteristics in which sort of the normal confidence, normal self-assurance, normal sort of goal-seeking behavior bleeds over into the sort of toxic self-absorption and toxic selfishness and compulsion that leads to negative outcomes. So I'm referring to not, oh, is that guy literally an egomaniac, but much more, you know, what are these traits that make us our own worst enemy, that put us at odds with the things that we say that we're trying to achieve?
Okay. All right. And I think what you're talking about is a timeless idea. I mean, it seems like a lot of the major religions or philosophies have talked about how ego can get in the way of yourself.
Yeah, certainly. I think at the root of every Greek tragedy, for instance, is hubris. And hubris would be a form of ego, you know, even if that word didn't necessarily exist. The idea of, you know, what happens when our sense of realism is replaced with delusions of grandeur? What do we do? What happens when we overestimate our own importance? You know, that it's a thing that essentially every religion and every philosophy ever has warned against. It just happens that today, I think we, you know, instead of warning against a lot of these things, we actually hold them up as positive attributes. This is what every motivational speaker is out there encouraging is sort of ego in one form or another, sadly.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like our culture today promotes this unhealthy, exaggerated ego. And you just talked about like the motivational speakers and but like a lot of the books about business and entrepreneurship, it's all about being self-promoting, like, you know, name it and take it and it's yours and all this other stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, just think of what social media is. It's not supposed to reflect your actual life. It's supposed to reflect your idealized life. And yet, you know, I think a lot of it is rooted in what you're just saying, this idea of sort of faking it till you make it. That's a seductive, egotistical idea that, you know, in my opinion, or in my experience, doesn't normally work out well for people. But, you know, you're supposed to dare greatly and have these grand visions of success and ambition and pursue your passion and your calling. We say a lot of these things, but they're not tempered with any sort of real purpose or any real understanding. Or in a lot of cases, we're encouraging them without any hard work either, right? And so it creates a scenario in which our grandiose impulses are encouraged and excited, and then the things that are supposed to temper and balance that out are left by the wayside.
Gotcha. We'll get into more of those things into detail. But before, like, what inspired you to write this book, Ego is the Enemy? Was it events in your own life, just observations from culture, or is it in some way a continuation of your work you started in The Obstacle is the Way?
It's a little bit of both, I think. So Obstacle is the Way was about external obstacles and how people can be sort of rational and creative and strategic about dealing with those obstacles and sort of using the stoic mindset in which to do so. And so I was sort of thinking about what comes next after that. I was really thinking, okay, what makes doing that so hard for people? And what is the biggest obstacle that most people face? And, you know, in my own experience and a lot of the people that I get emails from and my client work and the sort of powerful, important people that I've worked for, what I kept sort of sensing was that the enemy for most of us is ourselves. It's not, you know, DJ Khaled likes to talk about the they that are, you know, they don't want you to have this. They don't. In reality, most people don't, like, you know, the world is indifferent to you. What prevents people from achieving what they want to achieve is oftentimes their own bad habits, their own bad impulses. It's you know, their own ego that's getting in their way. And ego is what prevents, you know, looking at a situation rationally, not taking it personally. It's what prevents, you know, persistence and perseverance, because we feel like we shouldn't have to do these things. So it was sort of a coalescing of these two different, trains of thought that I had that, you know, ego prevents the hard work of overcoming obstacles. And ironically, ego tends to be its own enormous obstacle. And so that's sort of where I was coming from in the book. And originally the book was going to be about humility, which I know you guys have written a lot about. And I mean, you can tell me if you think I'm off base here, but I found that sort of talking about humility, one, it's a difficult thing to talk about because the first question is like, are you humble? Right? So it's like a different thing. It's a difficult thing to talk about, but also humility doesn't tend to be very inspirational to people, right? So it's difficult. I found that almost all the stories of humility sound more or less the same. They're not super action oriented. And so when I was thinking about writing about humility, I was trying to think of what is a way to come at it that would captivate people's attention and sort of actually be of practical use. And I realized that, you know, in many ways, ego is the opposite of humility. And so I decided to focus on ego as being this, you know, this impediment to the humility that we want and that we need. And so that's where the book came from.
Right. So you inverted, right? Instead of focusing on humility, you focused on the opposite of it. But by doing that, you were able to talk about humility.
Yes, exactly. And I think one, talk about humility in a way that is actionable and interesting to people. But two, I mean, it's a little bit of the message of the book itself, in that, you know, you sit down, you think you have one idea for a book. This is what you think you're going to do. And I mean, I had a contract to write a book about this topic. And then as I was going through the material, And mostly as I was doing my research and writing my notes and starting to sketch out this book, I realized that my vision or my plan was flawed and it wasn't going to work as I originally planned it. And so I think, you know, when people ask, you know, why does humility matter? Why does, you know, why is ego bad? In the most practical sense, any sort of creative pursuit or entrepreneurial venture, you start out with a sort of a gut instinct or an idea. But if you're not going to be open to feedback from the world, if you're going to be so certain that you are instinctually right, you're not going to be able to adapt and change when it turns out that things were more complicated than you thought, or that maybe you didn't have the experience, or you hadn't considered something yet. And so it's only in actually doing the thing and then being open to learning from it that you're able to grow and improve. And you know, this book wouldn't have been possible had I been convinced that I was immediately and unassailably correct with my original plan.
Right. So you had to overcome the ego to write your book about overcoming the ego.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you write a book proposal and the publisher says, we don't like it. You can say, hey, screw you, I'm going to self-publish, or screw you, I'm going to sell it to someone else. Or you can say, well, maybe I don't agree with why you don't like it, but something is clearly not right. And so what do I need to go back to the drawing board and, you know, do another pass at this and then another pass. And then actually making the book I think craft is inherently ego killing, because every day you're struggling against some problem, or, you know, you're falling short in the pursuit of perfection.
Yeah. So let's talk, the way you organize the book is interesting. You break it up into three sections and they correlate to three phases that you say people constantly find themselves in.
Yeah. So I mean, this might be getting a little too insider for people, but I believe that every book should have a three-part structure. And this came to me from Sean Coyne, who is Stephen Pressfield's editor, who's done amazing books like The War of Art and Gates of Fire. But, you know, all of, you know, going back to Greek literature, you've got your in Aristotle, you've got your three-part structure. And so I was trying to think, you know, what is a three-part structure? My last book was Perception, Action, and Will. The three-part structure of ego, I felt, was that when we're starting out, ego is destructive because it prevents us from learning. It makes us think we're better than we are. You know, it makes us want to move too quickly. You know, a number of destructive traits. And then after we aspire, you know, if we've conquered our ego there, then we achieve success in some way. So, you know, we've gotten a great job, you know, we've signed our first deal, we've been, you know, chosen in the draft, whatever it is, we're achieving some measure of success. Well, now ego manifests itself in another number of ways, right? It's feeling like you've suddenly arrived, that you're better than everyone else. That it's going to be amazing from here on out. You know, now maybe you've got people working under you, and so power is the corruptive nature of power is warping onto your ego. Maybe you feel like you've learned everything that there is to learn. These are the effects of ego in the success phase of our life. And then, you know, as we know, successful people either aspire to some new level of success, so they're essentially going back to the next step, or they fail in some way, or they find out that success has a new set of difficulties, right? Now all of a sudden they're in they're attacked by a media outlet, or, you know, the market shifts, or a competitor comes after them. So now they're dealing with adversity or difficulty or failure. And so ego here manifests itself in a number of other ways that are also destructive. You know, it's taking this thing personally, believing that you've been screwed over and giving into resentment or hatred, or you found yourself in a state of difficulty because you screwed up. You did something wrong. Well, can you admit that you did something wrong, and can you learn from this, or do you decide, hey, I'm doubling down on the problems that got me here? So whether you're aspiring, you're succeeding, or you're dealing with some form of adversity, ego is really the least helpful variable that you could introduce into any of those phases of your life. And I feel like we're in sort of a a constant fluid transition along that spectrum over the course of our entire lives.
And I imagine it's possible to be in those three phases the same time in different different phases at the same time in different facets of your life. So maybe you're
totally
right, aspiring with your career, but you succeeded in some other, you know, I don't know, you've run a marathon or something like that and you did well. You're that.
Yeah, absolutely. Or you're successful on the one hand and then you've started this other venture on the other. And so, you know, if you're bringing your ego of success, like, someone's a rapper and then they decide to become an actor, right? You can be egotistical in your musical profession and maybe you're getting away with it because you're so successful, even though it's causing problems for you. But if you bring that ego to this new thing that you're starting and you're convinced that ego is transferable, you're going to be rudely surprised when you're not nearly as good at that thing as you maybe think that you are. And you're not going to be able to improve and take, you know, feedback and work well with others and, you know, sort of hustle and build the relationships that you need to succeed in that other field. And so, that's where ego is such a tricky thing, is that, you know, we're never permanently in any of these phases. We're always doing and trying new things and maybe a project is partially successful and partially not successful. And our ego is what's going to sort of determine that balance, I think.
So like you did in Obstacles of the Way, you went to history to find examples of individuals who were good models of these different, of ego either getting in the way or them overcoming ego in these different phases of life. In the aspire phase, you talk about the Civil War General Sherman, who is, you know, controversial figure. But what can Sherman teach about managing our ego in the aspire phase?
Yeah, I mean, I do think it's interesting that he's a controversial figure. I don't totally understand the controversy 150 years removed from the event. But what I think so fascinating about Sherman is that he was, unlike a typical, you know, our sort of stereotype of a great general, maybe it's a MacArthur or a McClellan or you know, Napoleon, who sort of believed themselves to be marked for greatness from like the day that they were born. Sherman never really had any of that. In fact, you know, he was basically orphaned as a young boy. He grew up, he was adopted. He got into West Point, but he did not, was not particularly distinguished there. He had a series of sort of backwater postings. He was a figure during the gold rush and that, you know, he actually held the original gold nugget that was discovered that set off the gold rush, but he made no fortune in the gold rush. And even in the early days of the Civil War, he was sort of like a mediocre general. But what people didn't understand is that he was learning this entire time, that he was B.H. Liddell Hart, who wrote this amazing biography of Sherman, which I used in the book, is talking about, you know, for the person who thinks that they're destined for greatness, they never really accomplish enough and they never really enjoy what they're experiencing because they felt entitled to it. Whereas someone like Sherman, his sort of slow, gradual rise was a much sweeter process in that it's the accumulation of actual confidence and the accumulation of actual accomplishments. And so I think what Sherman managed to do was focus on what he was trying to accomplish more than his sort of personal vanity or goal. So, you know, at the Battle of Vicksburg, for instance, Donelson, Sherman technically outranked Grant, and similarly at Vicksburg, he could have been in a superior position, but he decided to subsume his personal his sort of personal ego and vanity to serving this greater mission. And they built a team where they functioned quite well together. And in fact, you know, Sherman's role at Vicksburg was actually one of a feint, a distraction, and he did not participate in the main thrust of the battle. But he would tell Grant over and over again, hey, like, look, I'm just here to do my part. And what they discovered together at Vicksburg, and I talk about this in Obstacle, what they discovered at Vicksburg was accidentally a strategy that Sherman would then use to win the Civil War, his march to the sea, which in itself was an exercise in the restraint of ego. The reason the U.S. Civil War went longer than it needed to, and why so many people died, is that the generals were convinced that it would be decided in a series of head-to-head battles. McClellan, who was much smarter than Sherman, who had all the credentials, who was given a superior command, would spend weeks and months waiting and maneuvering for these large decisive battles that he thought would decisively win the war, and they never happened. And what Sherman realized is that if he took the war to the enemy, if he took this march to the South, and he avoided these confrontations, and he instead focused on the objectives, the cities that he needed to take, and the sort of bringing what he called the hard hand of war to the Southern people, he would win. But that required a certain awareness and disdain for the vanity that had motivated these other generals. And so, you know, then the final thing I talk about in the book related to Sherman is after the war, Sherman is one of the most influential people in all of America, and he's essentially offered the presidency, and he says, you know what? No, I don't like politics. I have all the rank I want. The Sherman-esque statement is his famous statement, declining to run for presidency. If nominated, I will not run. If elected, I will not serve. He doesn't run for presidency. Grant wins the presidency. It's the worst thing that basically happens to him. Sherman was this model for me of someone who's very self-contained, very self-motivated, very realistic, you know, not pessimistic, but realistic in his assessment of himself and his own abilities. And I think that's what made him such a powerful force, ultimately, you know, for the good of the United States and for his own sort of personal happiness.
Right. Yeah. That contrast between Sherman and Grant was interesting. You know, Grant, yeah, went on to be the president. He was an okay president. Like,
yes.
I think he had some problems. Like, there's like a lot of
corruption. It didn't go well for him.
A lot of corruption within his presidency, et cetera.
Yeah, he basically bit off more than he could chew. He didn't have any, like, Grant, and I love Grant. I raved about him in Obstacle, but, you know, Grant was a great general because he didn't play politics. He focused on the task at hand, and that's why he worked so well with Lincoln. So for him to run for president was, I think, in a large part, a complete misunderstanding of his own strengths and weaknesses. But whatever, you know, Eisenhower ran for president and did pretty well. But so he ran for president and he did terrible. It sort of caught him by surprise how poorly it went, because he wasn't a great judge of character politically. And so, you know, this is where the corruption happened. And after his presidency, he starts a brokerage house with his son and an investor named Ferdinand Ward, who turned out to be basically a Bernie Madoff of his day. And it financially, Grant is bankrupted and ruined. He ends up having to literally to pawn his Civil War mementos, his sword, to pay off the debts that he incurred. And I remember Sherman wrote a letter. I don't remember if it was to Grant or someone else, but basically he was saying how sad it was that Grant was trying to, he said, Grant aimed to rival the millionaires who would have given anything to have won one of his battles. And so it's this inability to know sort of what's important to you, what you actually value, and try to compete with everyone else that often gets us into trouble.
Right. I mean, this is a perfect example of individuals who they succeeded in one area of life and they think, oh, well, I can succeed in this other area of life just because I was successful in this one other. And that's not how it works.
It's definitely not how it works. And we think, hey, it was easy last time, it'll be easy this time. And we don't really understand what went into our success the first time, oftentimes because we take it for granted. And we give ourselves a little bit of the halo effect. Because I was dominant in this area, naturally I must be dominant in this other area. And so you see so many people waste so much time and money. And I mean, ultimately, Grant died at like 63, partly reeling from these failures. And you know, what might America have looked like? What might have his life had looked like if he'd managed to resist that impulse. And I think that's very sad. It's a caution. I'm not judging him. I'm saying it's a cautionary tale for me that I try to live in my own life. It's like when you accomplish something, or you've built some level of success for yourself, all of a sudden these opportunities start coming your way, and you have to decide, hey, which of these opportunities are in any way adjacent or similar to what I'm already good at? You know, and do you even have an understanding of what you're good at? But ego can be this seductive force that really leads you astray.
So you also talk about John Boyd. We can't leave this podcast without talking about John Boyd, because he's one of my favorite characters from history, because he's this really complex character.
But super complex.
You use him as an example of not letting ego get in the way during the aspire phase. So what can we learn from the life of John Boyd about overcoming ego in that part of our life when we're just starting out on some venture?
Yeah, well, so what I would say is, first off, if you don't read my book, you should definitely read the Art of Manliness piece on the to be or to do speech, which is obviously I was familiar with this speech before from Robert Corum's amazing biography of Boyd, but that piece is that speech is what I based the story of Boyd on in one of the chapters. And basically what Boyd was famous for doing, people don't really know who he is. He was one of America's greatest fighter pilots, and then ultimately became sort of a warrior inside the Pentagon for reform and efficiency and strategy change inside the U.S. military. And he was much more influential as sort of a groomer of men than he was as an actual sort of leader of troops on the battlefield. But one of the things he would do is he had this speech as a young sort of acolyte would come into his orbit. He would see them for all their potential. He would know the sort of trajectory that most young officers would go through, which is they would show promise, and then they would start to sort of become addicted to the status, to the trappings of politics and power of their office or of their post, and how it would lead them astray and eventually make them sort of do more harm than good. And so he would give this speech where he would draw them in and he would say, look, you know, you're coming to a fork in the road. Are you going to be someone that does things, or are you going to be someone who is something? So basically saying, are you going to choose between status or influence? Are you going to choose between credit or accomplishment? And that speech was what I talk about, that because we as young people have to make that same choice as we're starting. Are we going to focus on sort of purpose and mission, or are we gonna focus on, you know, impressing people or financial rewards or any number of these superficial concerns that often lead many, many people astray? And so I read that speech when I was 19 years old. It was very influential to me in the idea of, like, man, credit is this seductive, egotistical thing that really prevents a lot of people from fulfilling their true and deepest potential. And I've sort of held him up as a model in my life of someone who said, look, I'd rather be the guy behind the scenes. I don't really care what people think of me, but I'd rather have influence than, let's say, power, or I'd rather have, you know, accomplishment versus credit and recognition.
Did you know Fast Growing Trees is the biggest online nursery in the U.S. with more than 10,000 different kinds of plants and over 2 million happy customers in the United States? They have everything you could possibly want, like fruit trees, palm trees, evergreens, houseplants, and so much more. Fast Growing Trees makes it easy to order online, and your plants are shipped directly to your door in 1 to 2 days. So I got a tree from Fast Growing Trees. I had a tree in my front yard that had to cut down, a big giant oak tree, because it died. And I wanted to put a maple tree there, one that turned bright red during the fall. So I found that tree, made sure that it fit the climate that we're at here in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Ordered it. A few days later, I got the tree in a box. It's crazy they can send a tree in a box. And I planted it. A few weeks after I planted it, it's already starting to sprout leaves. So I think in a few years, I'm going to have that bright red maple tree that happens in the fall. I'm really looking forward to that. So if you want to try Fast Growing Trees out, this spring they have the best deals online, up to half off on select plants and other deals. And listeners to our show get an additional 15% off with their first purchase when using code manliness at checkout. That's an additional 15% off at fastgrowingtrees.com using code manliness at checkout. Fastgrowingtrees.com, code manliness. Offer is valid for a limited time. Terms and conditions may apply. Texas Pete is the sauce that allows you to sauce like you mean it. Each Texas Pete sauce is packed with a bold, balanced flavor. The signature tanginess is what makes it a legendary hot sauce that can be used on just about anything. You're definitely going to want to try every flavor. The original hot sauce has a famous secret blend of fermented peppers. Their hotter hot sauce is 3 times hotter than the original, and it's not for the faint of heart. They also got a flavor called Sabor by Texas Pete, adds authentic Mexican flavor. And they also have a dust dry seasoning that matches the flavor of the original hot sauce and a flavorful dry rub. But the flavor that I've been enjoying lately is the chopped sriracha sauce. It's got chili, garlic, and some tropical tangy notes. It's really good. I love putting it on my eggs. Texas Pete, sauce like you mean it. Visit TexasPete.com and use the store locator to find Texas Pete products as well as purchase sauces and get recipe inspiration. And you can use promo code PODCAST24 for 20% off at TexasPete.com. That's PODCAST24 for 20% off at TexasPete.com. Check out the Sriracha Cha Sauce. It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining on the pants. You can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy to follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code MANLINESS to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code MANLINESS. Check it out today. There's a famous Abraham Lincoln quote that goes something like, "Good things come to those who wait." That's only part of the quote. The full quote is, "Good things come to those who wait, but only the things left by those who hustle." Well, if you're a business owner and want the best people on your team, the same applies. Thankfully, ZipRecruiter puts the hustle in your hiring, so you can find qualified candidates fast. And now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. ZipRecruiter's smart technology finds top talent for your roles right away. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's matching technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Let ZipRecruiter give you the hiring hustle you need. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/manliness to try it for free. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Right, and that's what happened in his life. Like he wasn't able to advance to general. He stayed a lieutenant colonel for his career.
Yeah.
Because he was focused on these, reforming the Pentagon, and the top brass didn't like that. And, but in the end, like the tactics and the strategy and the whole approach to warfare that he developed, that was used during the first Gulf War, by the Marines. And like, it's what allowed us to like basically end the war in like a few days.
Totally. Yeah. He did not lead troops in battle, but he influenced the entire scope and battle plan of all of the troops across, across the different branches of the armed forces, which is, he really lived what he was talking about. There's no aircraft carrier named after John Boyd. And, he died in, they were saying, a somewhat dingy apartment, but he was uncorrupted, and he was pure and true to what he believed in. And he, I think, ultimately accomplished far more than he would have had he, coveted these other things. And, that's something that I think every young person faces. You got to say, like, look, to be or to do, who am I going to be? What is important to me? I think Sherman faced this, and I think a lot of great people. What path am I going to follow in life? Am I going to follow the one that maybe gets me paid really well right out of the gate, or am I gonna put in the time and the hours to be self-sufficient and free and able to able to do the things that I actually think are important and that I need to be done.
So another part thing you talk about in the book in the Aspire phase that trips particularly young people up is this idea of passion. We've had other guests on the show talk about how passion can trip people up. But instead of passion, right? I know we shouldn't have passion and we can talk about why, but what should we have instead of passion?
Well, I think, you know, I'm using passion in the more pure sense of its definition, like what the Greeks would say, the passions, right? Like the sort of the uncontrollable urges and energy that they sort of saw as dangerous. I think, so when I hear people go, I'm following my passion, I sort of get the sense that they're just being whipped around by something that they don't quite control. I would contrast passion with purpose. Purpose is, this is what, you know, purpose is the John Boyd approach. It's, this is what is important. This is what I'm trying to do. This is the larger mission that I'm serving, rather than, you know, I've just got to do this. I'm so passionate. I'm so excited. Let's go, let's go, let's go. I think purpose is deliberative and patient and controlled, and passion is zealous and unrestrained. And so I think someone with purpose is able to sacrifice, they're able to play a longer game, they're able to you know, put up with things that maybe they would have rather not had to. Like Jackie Robinson was not passionate about baseball. Jackie Robinson you know, integrated baseball as someone on a mission of immense purpose. And that's what allowed him to say, you know, not punch someone in the face who deserved to be punched in the face. Or you know, not at Branch Rickey said, you know, I want someone who has the guts not to fight back. Someone with purpose has that. Someone with passion is I think sort of a, you know, a vessel that can barely contain itself.
Right. I had Angela Duckworth on the podcast last week, and that's what she, like her, she's like the grit lady.
Yeah.
And yeah, she says purpose is the thing you got to have. That's what allows you to have, or one of the factors that allows you to have grit to see things through the long through, and you have this purpose that you're dedicated to. And even when things get tough, you're still going to stick to it. And yeah, and passion is fleeting, right? It's emotionally based. And so one day you might feel great and super passionate and excited, but the next day, not so much. And
yeah, or like I see this with a lot of authors, right? They'll go like, oh, I'm passionate. I want to do a book. And it'll be like, about what? They're like, I don't know. And it's like, okay, someone who has purpose is saying, this is what I believe, and this is what I want to communicate to the world, and maybe a book is the best way for me to do that. Or when they decide that a book is the best way to do it, then they're all in. But passion is, hey, someone said I should do this, and now that's why I'm doing it, and let's go right now. You know what I mean? You know, was it Christopher McCandless? He's passionate about the wild. I want to go into the wild. I got to pursue this calling. And then he goes there and he's not remotely trained or knowledgeable enough to do it. And he dies a tragic, unnecessary death there. And, you know, hey, we've got to make it to the summit of Everest, even though all the warnings are against it. And, you know, everyone is saying it's a bad idea. Passion is able to override that. You know, and get past it. That's not admirable to me. You know, Shackleton, I've got to get back to my men. I've got to rescue my men. That's purpose. You know, that is admirable to me.
All right. So we've been talking about the Aspire phase, and I can see how this part of the life cycle of any venture can trip up a lot of young people. Because yeah, we get these grandiose ideas, we get those motivational posters, put them on Instagram, talking about how we're going to do great things, blah blah blah, and a lot more talk, a lot less action. I guess the bottom line is, in the Aspire phase, just more action, less talk.
Yes, more action, less talk, and more openness and less certainty and self-absorption.
Okay. So let's move on to the success phase. You aspire to it, you've set your goals, you've worked, you've achieved success. And I think it was Napoleon who said that, you know, the most dangerous moment in any battle is the moment of victory. Why is that? How does success get in the way of success?
Well, I think what Napoleon is saying is that it's at that moment of victory that you kid, you think that you've earned the right to relax. You think that's where you make your gravest mistakes. And in many ways, the stakes are highest at that moment as well. So, you know, that you might have been disciplined when you were on the ascent because you sort of knew you needed to be, but now you're successful or you feel like you've earned some victory. Now chaos and disorder may take over, or bad habits that were suppressed early on now come come home to roost. And so what I think success requires is not, or what success needs is not ego, not complacency, but sort of a doubling down on the good habits that created that success in the first place. So, you know, if it was your dedication to learning that took you to this place, one cannot say, well, and now I know everything I need to know, so it's all good. It's you know, Genghis Khan says, or I talk about Genghis Khan in the book, and that really what was so profound about him as a conqueror was that at every new country he took over, he saw as essentially a superior culture that he needed to absorb into his empire and into his way of thinking. What can I learn from this enemy that I just vanquished? You know, what is the best that their society has to offer? I'm just saying, you know, if you feel pride, you cannot lead. And this idea that one must always remain a student and one must always resist the impulse to feel like that this success that they've achieved says something about them as a person, that it says that you're better than you were before you had the success.
So I get the idea about always being a student, like maintain that white belt mentality. I thought one of the chapters that you had was interesting was about, like you said, mentioned earlier, like doubling down on the habits or actions you did to get you to the success and continue that, and actually like developing a system for that. And I think that's hard for a lot of, particularly like entrepreneurs, artists, writers. They think that's sort of stodgy and stifles creativity, but you argue that that's actually what's going to allow you to continue your success that you've gained.
Sure. I'll give you an example of this. It's a somewhat current one. So Donald Trump has run probably one of the most impressive presidential campaigns of the last century. I don't admire him as a politician at all. I think he's a horrendous person. But it's one cannot help but be blown away that the fact that this guy beat out 16 or 17 other candidates totally on his own with a staff of like five people. Like it's astounding when you think about how little he spent, how little experience he had in this, and the, you know, billions of dollars of free media attention that he's been able to do to cobble together this nomination, right? So you could argue that previously he was in the aspirational phase and now he's achieved some measure of success in that he's now the presumptive nominee as we're talking. I don't know when this comes out, if he'll actually be the nominee yet. I don't think so, but he'll be the nominee, right? And so he could be forgiven for thinking, like, let's say, God forbid he wins the presidency. If he thinks that the sort of amateur-esque, tiny team that he managed to win the campaign with is going to function the same way in terms of governing the one of the most powerful countries in the world, he's going to be sorely mistaken. And in fact, we saw the same thing happen with the Obama campaign. When they won in 2008, they felt like, I remember there was a lot of interesting articles. They'd built this sort of technologically based team. It was decentralized. It was fast moving. It was filled with lots of young people, so all this stuff. And then they just assumed it would naturally transfer over to the bureaucracy that is, you know, the executive branch of the United States. And then they were rudely surprised when, hey, they weren't using the same computers, that there were legal constraints and that you had to run things through certain processes. And hey, all of a sudden, the things that got you there aren't the things that are going to allow you to be successful once you're there. And so I think that's similar to a lot of us. Like, we can be young, we can be scrappy and fluid and loose on our way up. And I've certainly had to go through some of these growing pains myself. But then once you've arrived, you have to now you're the man. You know, you were railing against the man before, but now you're the man, and people are counting on you and expecting certain things from you, and you're expected to perform and operate at a certain level that, you know, things you were able to get away with before are not possible now. And, you know, you could argue maybe that that's what sunk Ulysses S. Grant versus a Dwight D. Eisenhower, who came in and really instituted a sense of order and purpose and discipline to the White House. But that requires a sense that, hey, maybe the way that I want to do things are not the way that things are going to have to be. And I'm going to be okay accepting that. I'm going to put in the hard work to do what needs to be done.
Well, I'm curious, Ryan. I mean, you're a writer. And you're a successful one. How has your approach to your craft and your business changed since you've gained success? I mean, Obstacle of the Way is a New York Times bestseller, right?
Not New York Times, but it sold very, very well, which, you know, in some ways, I don't want to say it caught me off guard, but it certainly sold better than I expected. And as I finished this book, you know, I think one of the things you have to do in that position is okay, now the expectations are higher. You know, I'm not freed from those expectations. I have to deliver to an audience. I have to hit a certain mark. Right. And ideally in a career, you're always getting better than you were before. So now the expectations have changed, and that's something that's managed or that has to be managed. But I think the big thing that happens when people are successful, whether you're a writer, an entrepreneur, or even executive, is that you more responsibilities and obligations are thrust upon you. So where I was able to write the last book without as many interruptions, you know, now I've got interviews that I have to do or speaking gigs that I have to do, or my business is taking off, so I have more clients. Now, if I don't have the discipline to institute a system or a schedule that I stick to, or if I'm not able to prioritize and I treat everything that happens equally, that is a recipe for dropping some major balls, making errors, you know, letting people down. You know, I mentioned Eisenhower. You guys have an amazing post on Eisenhower's priority matrix about urgency versus important. That is the situation that success puts you in, is you've got so many demands on your time that if you can't properly prioritize and order them and deal with them accordingly, you're going to find yourself consumed with some trivial matter that used to be part of your job, but you're too egotistical to delegate. And so, you know, those are just some of the ways that you find yourself, you know, in a position of abundance, certainly, but that doesn't mean that there are not problems related to it.
Right. I think that the delegation, right? There's lots of books and articles about delegating, but I think, yeah, the thing that keeps people from delegating is ego. They think, like, I can do this better than the other guy I'm going to delegate this to.
Totally. And here's why it's egotistical. You're right. I can do most of the things that I have to delegate. I mean, there's the stuff I don't like, you know, booking travel or, you know, scheduling. I don't like that. But a lot of the things that I now have to delegate, I like doing, or I know that I'm really good at. But you have to be able to do the calculation that says, hey, I'm handing this off to this person and it's going to be done, you know, 10% not as well going forward. But the trade-off for that is I have to do this other thing and I'm the only person in the world that can do that thing. You know, like, I'm the only one that can write my books. I mean, I guess theoretically there's ghostwriters, but given that this is my job, I'm the only one that can do that. So, you know, Kobe Bryant, you know, he's the only one that can get on the court and play as Kobe Bryant. So as these endorsements and, you know, maybe he's actually great at negotiating contracts, and it seems silly to give someone a 15% commission for negotiating your contracts for you. But if that's distracting from the training that he has to do, or that's occupying his mind so he's not thinking about the next game with the same dedication that he did before, all of a sudden his performance on the court is going to suffer. And, you know, I'm not Kobe Bryant, I'm not saying that, but all of us deal with that problem in our own way, that we're the only ones that can do some of the things. And if we're not able to delegate, those things are going to suffer. Like, there's a quote I have in the book from Eisenhower's chief of staff. He's saying, the president does the most important things and I do the next most important things. And if you can't build the approximation of that, you know, into your own life once you're successful, I don't think success is going to last that long for you, or it's going to be very miserable.
Yeah. So let's talk about failure. Everyone's going to fail at some point in their life. How is ego the enemy when we fail? Because that's like the moment we fail. It's like when you think people would like that, you wouldn't have any ego, right?
Or you think that ego was helpful because it would help you sort of protect you in that moment of vulnerability.
Right.
But in fact, the vulnerability is good because by preventing you from having it, it's preventing you from capitalizing on it. So it's like, you know, let's say you were egotistical in your success and you alienated people and you made some mistake or you overreached. You know, failure is in that way is a moment of truth, right? It's exposing this thing that maybe you didn't want to be true. And the worst thing that can happen is for you to bury your head in the sand, right? The worst thing that can happen is that, you know, you hit what should be rock bottom, but you're too hard-headed to accept that that's what in fact has happened. And that happens a lot. Like, I mean, think about Steve Jobs, right? Steve Jobs is fired from Apple, by John Sculley, because he'd become unmanageable. He was unaccountable. He was basically unhinged. He could have taken that and said, this guy screwed me over. He screwed me over. This is the worst thing that's ever happened to me. I'm going to retire with my money and millions and live a life of luxury or whatever. But instead he said, he basically, you know, and he was an egotistical person, but he started two other companies and those companies were better than Apple. And he learned from those mistakes. I mean, one of those companies was Pixar. He learned from those mistakes. He went on a journey of self-improvement and introspection. And ultimately, he came back to Apple and built it into the world's most valuable company. But that's not what most people do when they're fired. Most people get fired and then they hold a grudge and they believe that they've been screwed over or wronged. And they continue down that negative path. It becomes a downward spiral for them. And so what ego does when we fail is it refuses to learn the lessons inherent in that failure and set us up for greater failure.
Right. I think you call this narcissistic injury.
Yeah. Yeah. Narcissistic injury, it is a psychological term. It's like when something happens and we take that as an injury to our identity and to our fragile sense of self. Like when gang members kill each other, it's tragic, but it's funny. It's like the things they kill each other over are these things that a normal person would be like, wait, what do you care that he said that about you? Like, you know, but because they're so, their narcissistic ego is so fragile, the idea that someone would bump up against them or that someone would disrespect them, you know, in quotes, leads them to do this horrible thing that is, you know, obviously, going to jail is far worse than, you know, somebody tagging a wall in your neighborhood or whatever. But the narcissistic injury, it's so fragile that it has to sort of deal with this threat in an overblown, you know, preposterous fashion. And so I think so much of what happens to us when we're consumed by ego is that we take the success that we've achieved and we say that it says something about us as a person. And then logically, when we fail or when we're snubbed by someone or we're disrespected by someone, we take that as a statement about our identity as well. And often that makes us overreact in such a damaging fashion that it's far worse than whatever had happened already.
Right. And on the flip side, it doesn't even have to be someone else doing something to you. It could just be like fate, you know, just like luck, chance.
Totally.
Cause you to fail, right? You started your business at the wrong time. There's a downturn in the economy. Yet because of that narcissistic ego, you would think it's like, well, it's something I did, right? I messed up. Even though like anyone else in your position would have done the exact same thing.
Sure. And ego makes it hard to ask for help. It makes it hard for you to reevaluate your decisions. It makes it impossible for you to see this thing objectively because you're so tied up in it. And so it either makes, what could have been a small problem into a full-blown catastrophe, or it just delays the inevitable. It's kicking the can down the road. And when you come back to it, it's worse. There's so many people, you know, they narrowly dodge a crisis, but instead of learning from it, the next crisis is just, you know, 10x, you know, more explosive.
So, Ryan, we've been talking about how ego can be the enemy, but is ego always a bad thing? Because, like, you know, look, I'm a big student of history. Churchill was an admitted egoist, right? Extremely, like, he was supremely egotistical. Even Teddy Roosevelt, you could say, was supremely egotistical. Yet ego is like what drove these guys, what they were doing. They feel like they had something to offer people, right? They're so narcissism that they felt that they were the guys who were there to save democracy, or, like, you know, Teddy Roosevelt in his case, you know, clean up the muck, you know, that was in the corruption that was going on. So, I mean, how can you balance that? I mean, what is going on there? Is that, would you call that ego, or is it something else? Or is some, can egos can sometimes be beneficial in small doses?
Yeah, I mean, look, that's the fascinating question about this. Why are there so many incredibly successful, accomplished, even admirable people who did have big egos? A friend of mine, Daniel O'Brien, wrote a book about presidents, and he's like, look, to be told when you're like 10 or 11 years old, you know, that the president is the most powerful man in the world, and to think like, oh, that should be me, like, requires a certain amount of ego and maybe even a bit of insanity. And so, you know, there's no question that people who feel that unending drive to not just be successful, but to be like the number one person on earth, that's going to require a certain amount of ego, I think. But when you look at people like Winston Churchill, or we'll start with Churchill. Churchill was, on the one hand, incredibly talented, super smart, courageous, wise, you know, honorable, all these amazing things. I think that's why he was successful, not because of his ego. You know, a lot of musicians were drug addicts, but that wasn't what fueled their music. In fact, that took away from it. And like, when you look at Churchill's life, often he was right so often, but he alienated many people, and he would hurt his own chances of success, because he didn't understand that the way that he dominated conversations, the way that he overstepped his bounds, the way that he impeded on other people's things, like, he was convinced that being right all the time was all that mattered. And in fact, if he'd had a little bit more empathy and a little bit more understanding, he'd have been probably more successful. His deep conviction that he was right about Nazi Germany, whereas everyone else was wrong, that worked when he was right in that instance. But there were other times in his career where he felt he was equally right and had unending confidence and egotism, convinced that, you know, he was that, and he was wrong. And so it's a double-edged sword. And I think, you know, someone like TR is similar in the sense that if you watch the Roosevelt documentary that Ken Burns just did, it's the same thing. You see this guy who at the end of his life has so clearly been driven by this compulsion that he cannot be still, he cannot do anything, that it, you know, it forced him to run for his disastrous sort of third term. He turned on his protege, who was one of his close friends. You know, he did this adventure in South America that nearly killed him. He forced his kids to fight in World War I, where they died. You know, it wasn't necessarily easy to be Theodore Roosevelt. And I think some of us would be aghast at the cost of that ego in his personal life as well.
So yeah, it's a double-edged sword.
I think so. It forces you, in some ways you have to be a little bit crazy to go this far. But it's a gamble whether that craziness is ultimately going to sort of take a hard toll on you as well. And so it's like, when we look at these really successful egotists, we also want to look back and think, okay, is there a politician who was just as egotistical as Winston Churchill, whose career ended disastrously because of that ego? Almost certainly so. And so
Adolf Hitler.
Yeah, right. The survivorship bias gives us a warped picture of of these things, I think.
Right. Well, Ryan, this has been a great conversation. Where can people learn more about Ego is the Enemy?
So the book is available everywhere, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, coming out in a bunch of different languages, which I'm really excited about. And then you can go to my website, ryanholiday.net, and read my stuff there.
Awesome. Well, Ryan Holiday, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. It's always good to talk to you.
My guest today was Ryan Holiday. He's the author of the book, Ego is the Enemy. You can find more information about his work and the book at ryanholiday.net. And it also is available at amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. Also, make sure to check out the show notes for this podcast at aom.is/ego. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. And if you enjoy the show, I'd really appreciate it if you give us a review on iTunes. Help spread the word about the show. As always, I appreciate your continued support. And until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently. At capella.edu.